Bulletproof Radio, a state of high performance.
You're listening to Bulletproof Radio with Dave Asprey.
Everyone's talking about red light therapy beds, and for good reason. There's a company called ARRC LED that's building an entirely new class of LED devices. ARRC LED beds integrate proprietary scanning technology and frequency protocols to shape the delivery of six different wavelengths in dose-optimized photobiomodulation. Yes, that's a lot of words. What it is, though, is that photobiomodulation improves the underlying energetics of the cells in your body. And those changes can benefit nearly every tissue and organ and system in your body. You change your cells and you change your life. For more information, visit arrcled.com.
Quick question for you. What makes you feel more invigorated, less stressed, and more in control of your body? The answer, more energy. Specifically, more quantum energy, because our bodies are quantum systems. Leela Quantum Tech has figured out a way to harness quantum energy so you can reach a state of vibrancy that you've probably never felt. Dozens of studies show that Leela Q's products neutralize the effects of harmful EMFs around us and even release positive energy that can improve your blood flow, optimize your heart rate, and other benefits. Leela Q has some heavy science backing it up. A recent study looked at people who use Leela Q for just 10 minutes. The study used a special blood illumination technique called dark field microscopy, and it showed significant protective and improvement effects on blood flow. So take a quantum leap into higher vibration at LeelaQ.com/Dave and claim your exclusive 10% discount.
And we're finally to the cool fact of the day. Looks like a few hundred years ago, a Turkish law made it legal for a woman to divorce her husband if he did not bring home a daily quota of coffee. And to be fair, it's said that at one point in Turkish culture, men would judge a woman's ability to make a good wife based on her ability to brew coffee. So this seems like there was some sort of equality here. Well, you know, you gotta say, coffee, law. I like these laws.
Hey there, ice bath lovers. Do you want to take your cold exposure game up a notch with some contrast therapy? Well, you should, because cold plunges and contrast therapy can lower stress, up your immunity, and even help you sleep better. It works better than just cold therapy alone. Well, now you can do that with the new Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tubs by Master Spas. Whether you want to relax in a hot soak or get energized with a cold plunge, the Michael Phelps Chili Goat Cold Tub has you covered. You can easily hop out of the hot water, get in the cold water, and go back and forth. When you do that, you get better results in less time, and that's what biohacking is all about. Go to chiligoattubs.com, use promo code DAVE500, and you can save $500 on any Chili Goat cold tub. I have one in my backyard. That's chiligoattubs.com, promo code DAVE500.
Today's guest isn't about coffee, but he's an associate professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, a board-certified internist, and he's very well-known and internationally renowned for his work in integrative gastroenterology and nutrition, a founding member of the American Board of Integrative Medicine, and he's been selected as one of America's top physicians since 2004. And he just came out with The Gut Balance Revolution, and he runs thefoodmd.com. I'm talking about, if you haven't already heard of him, Dr. Gerard Mullen. Dr. Mullen's also lost 100 pounds on his microbiome diet, and this is why I wanted to have him to talk on the show, to talk about gut biomes. So Gerard, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
By the way, I didn't ask ahead of time, would you like to be called Dr. Mullen because you're wearing kind of the lab coat sort of set up there, or should I call you Gerard? What do you like on the radio?
I don't know. People that call me Dr. Jerry.
Dr. Jerry, there we go. So you normally ask ahead of time, but I didn't, so my bad.
That's okay.
All right, Dr. Jerry. I've been looking a lot at gut balance and the microbiome. It's been a major problem for me. I used to weigh 300 pounds. I weigh closer to 200 pounds now, so we've both lost that 100 pounds. And gut balance is a core part of it, but what's your take on it? Because you're as studied in that topic as just about anyone can be. What's the connection between the gut and those things like your heart, your brain, and your waist? Just kind of give me the download there.
Well, in a nutshell, I'll give you a little bit of my story, the journey, and kind of make the connection to the data, is that when I was going to college, and I was about the 293 is what I weighed in, as they would say at the championship fights. I weighed 293 when I went to see a doctor for myonucleosis. And at that point in time, I was interested in being a physician, which he found to be laughable. And it was sobering. And I went to the supermarket and I picked up a little book on fiber. It was all about how fiber was good for you and fiber can help you lose weight. So I would combine that with yogurt, different fibrous products and bran, let's say oat bran. And I just started to see the weight come off. 20 or 30 years later, here we are. I've lost the weight and doing other things that were, microbiome shifting. And the data is really exploded. And the connection between the microbiome and virtually every organ system and optimizing and controlling, it's really fascinating, as you mentioned. So if we really want to optimize our health, we got to start from within.
So why was it laughable that you were going to become a doctor back then?
To him, not really clear why, but he said in his own words, looking like that, to my mother.
Ouch.
Is that looking like that? She asked a question, because I had a sore throat with the mononucleosis and found it difficult to eat, and he found it to be, that would be therapeutic.
Wow.
And you could use to drop a few pounds. Product of the medical school system back then, perhaps, or for whatever reason. But the words were very penetrating and unforgettable. And I definitely had motivation to succeed once I heard that.
Do you think that there's some... I may put you on the spot here. Is there some truth to the idea, don't trust a fat physician?
don't trust maybe an obese weight loss doctor.
There you go. That's a fair point, because I do know some obese physicians. If they're going to set my arm, great. If they're going to tell me what to eat, it's like, if it doesn't work for you. So
that's funny. But there are bestsellers who do that. There are people who made the best-selling lists promoting books who are, unfortunately, are overweight. But that's the business.
It is.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of the business, what about detox? When you have toxins in the guts, people talk about detox, but there's also like the Betty Ford kind of meaning of detox. But so is detox, as a Johns Hopkins guy, is detox a marketing kind of thing, or is this a real thing?
It's funny. It all depends. It all depends because the term detox is taken pretty negatively in the academic world.
Yeah.
And I remember giving a lecture to the American Dietetic Association on their center stage at one of their conferences about it. And there's a lot of evidence for principles about detoxification, But the problem is that you have the word detox applied and people do pretty crazy things and say they're detoxing. And it may not be too healthy for them. I mean, with the gut is a very robust, very resilient system, and you don't want to starve it. You got to gently recultivate it. You don't want to shock it. And unfortunately, with some of these detox approaches, you do yourself more harm than good. But there is some truth and some benefit to really start to kind of renew the gut, and that's what I talk about in Gut Balance Revolution, is how to do it in a phased system, not as a one-time 10-day shock, which unfortunately is promoted by many.
So if you were to do, a green smoothie cleanse, and you only have green smoothies for 10 days or something like that, what's going to happen?
Well, what's going to happen is that you're likely devoid of protein. And you don't have glutamine to maintain your gut, you'll break down your gut integrity, and the bacterial toxins will start to, unfortunately, penetrate into your blood system, which is pro-inflammatory. So as much as you're getting benefit from having a lot of greens, which are phytonutrients, the confounding variable, what's counterproductive, is the fact that you're not supporting your system well enough, and even prebiotics for your bacteria, the good bacteria to grow.
When I was a raw vegan for almost a year, it's hard to remember, it might have been 8 months or something like that. This is going back a while. I at first experienced benefits that were probably detox related, but then soon started experiencing there's things going wrong I haven't had go wrong before. I have more allergies than I did before, more food sensitivities, a lot more. My thyroid isn't working the way it used to, and sort of ground myself down. through well-meaning efforts with, you know, stuff that kind of made sense on the surface but just didn't work. Do you see that a lot in integrative medicine, where people have maybe, you know, done more harm than good through attempting to detox?
Well, what I've seen some people try to do in detoxing is do, you know, enemas. Let's say they've done a lot of high-pressure enemas from below, or called hydrotherapy.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've read and heard of a lot of cases of perforation and dissemination, bacteremia, and things like that, where, you know, our bodies really weren't built for that. And you could certainly, quote unquote, purge yourself orally and not undergo a potentially harmful line of therapy. But other people swear by it. So other people feel great after, you know, having these cathartics. But there are downsides that you don't hear about, but they are published.
Yeah, it's funny. I learned the hard way with coffee enemas, which are pretty popular for detox. You have to cool the coffee off first. Like, that's the, no. Sorry, that's an old joke. But I do get people posting about coffee enemas. I'm like, well, I suppose using low toxin coffee is the way to go. And there's some evidence for those. But I've also seen people do crazy stuff with colon hydrotherapy that's probably not medically sound. And like you're saying, you know, you can do harm, and there's supposed to be stuff growing there. If you wash it all out, what are you replacing it with? And oftentimes in detoxes, it seems like that's not part of it. What's the kind of detox that is real? Like, what are the things you focus on if someone says, someone does have these lipopolysaccharides permeating from their gut, they haven't had enough of the right amino acids, something's not right, how do you guide them to detox?
I think of a way, and it's a line of medicine you might have heard about called functional medicine.
Of course, yeah. We've had lots of functional medicine practitioners on.
There you go. So the line of thinking that I also talk about in the book is to remove the toxins, right? Remove the things that are causing quote-unquote toxicity, so the toxic foods get to be removed.
You remove them from the diet or from the body is, I guess, the question.
Sorry, from the diet.
Oh, from the diet, okay. Love
Cut
that.
Cut off the
okay.
supply yeah. and, you know, don't purge the body of toxins that may be harboring in the gut. Cut off the supply to pathogens by cutting off some of these bad foods in quote-unquote the Western diet, the highly glycemic foods, the foods that promote inflammatory fats. And you don't want to have these bad bacteria fester and take over the gut, because the gut was meant to really have a harmonious balance of symbiotic bacteria that make us thrive. So I'd rather, you know, alter the diet, and the diet will help heal the gut and help promote the right balance of bacteria. And that in turn will help renew and regenerate, you know, your gut bacteria and your gut lining.
So that's so important when people stop eating, especially stop eating the crap. What about, though, this idea of calories? There's a lot of people who say, well, you want to lose weight, eat less, work out more. What's your take on that?
So I have a patient that I saw earlier this morning who has been gaining weight. He's up in the almost the mid 300s, about 320 or so, and his BMI, body mass index, is 45. And he has, as he has decreased his calorie intake, caloric intake, and increased his exercise, he's been gaining weight.
Oh, that happened to me.
And that's not unusual.
Yeah.
You know, because what's happening is that as you're exercising, you're actually, unless you're really doing it the right way, you're burning lean body mass as much as you're burning fat. And fat and lean body mass metabolizes fat. And in fact, as you break down your gut from the lack of protein intake, your gut barrier starts to break down and become more inflammatory. So, and then you're, you know, from a metabolic point of view, if you look at Jonathan Baylor's work.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you reach this set point, and your body is smart, and it slows down its metabolism. As you start to quote unquote lose weight initially, your metabolism slows down to kind of counteract your measures to lose weight. So at some point, if you use this calorie in, calorie out theory, you're going to have a plateau, and actually the weight you're going to lose is going to be more muscle, which is more vital to you and actually burns fat. So it's very few people find lasting success with that model.
It's funny, because despite the fact that you might lose 20 pounds, but you'll gain 30, and then you'll lose 30, but you'll gain 40, and it's brutal. Any fat person who's tried that will tell you this. Like, it is the rule, not the exception. But you still see tons of usually relatively young people who've never been obese, so just stand up and say, well, here's some studies that say it's always calories in, calories out, and it's all about caloric balance. And my experience was, I looked around one day when I weighed 300 pounds. I worked out 6 days a week, an hour and a half a day. And I'm like, wait a minute, all my friends are eating French fries and double cheeseburgers. I'm having the chicken salad with no dressing. I eat less than all of them. I'm bigger than all of them. And I can pick up all of my friends and bench press them, and I'm still fat. And I just realized, you know what? Like I'm tilting at windmills here with this kind of stuff. And that was one of my big wake-up calls. Why is that happening?
Well, you know, it kind of goes back to the gut. What's happening is that when your bacteria are out of balance, they become more efficient at taking in and keeping those calories. So let's say you and I, for example, if we had a meal and one of us was heavy again, you know, knock wood, we that never happens. Yeah. But if one of us was back when, you know, when I was younger or you were younger, and our bacteria were out of balance, those bacteria are very smart in trying to keep to metabolize the food that we take and make more efficiently use out of them calorically, absorb the calories, absorb the fat, convert the fiber to really short chain fatty acids, which are really higher in calories than just the carbohydrates. And altogether, we're actually become more efficient at retaining calories if the gut bacteria are out of balance. That's the key, and they found that in so many studies. First in animals around 2004, 2005, you can actually transplant the bacteria into the mice without any bacteria and make them fat when they're lean.
I referenced that in the Bulletproof Diet for people who say it's about calories. Like, this is not possible. You take a thin mouse, put poop in him, and he gets to be a fat mouse on the same food. It means it's not calories. Like, it's perfect proof in any universe, but people still don't see that. Yeah.
And even the obese individuals that are human, their bacteria are similarly out of balance as what they found in the mice. So it's true.
So you're talking about the ratio of Firmicutes to Bacteriodetes, those two species?
That is correct.
Awesome.
That is correct.
I was looking through a lot of research trying to figure out why I stumbled across, okay, I'm trying to gain weight. I was trying to disprove the calories thing. I was doing between 4,000 and 4,500 calories a day. And I was hoping, but I was doing almost all fat and a little bit of protein some veggies. Right. And I thought, you know, I'm probably going to gain like 3 pounds a week, but the math says I should gain 20 pounds. And I'm just going to write about how this, it just doesn't work. But I felt really good and I actually grew abs. Like, the only picture of my abs I ever posted was during that time. I saw stretch marks from being fat. I'm not like a cover model, I'm a dad. But it was really interesting because when I dug through, why would I possibly have lost weight during this time? I came across a study from China where they fed mice butter and coffee and saw a shift in the gut biome. I don't know how they did the study, but they found a shift of Bacteriodetes and Firmicutes, which the so-called fat people bacteria and thin people bacteria. And so the idea was that, wow, fat affects your gut biome. In your work, have you looked at how fat or polyphenols, in this case, what they do to shift those ratios?
You know, it's interesting, not in my particular work, scope of work, but in terms of the research, you're right, the polyphenols clearly are prebiotic.
Yes.
They will shift you into a more efficient metabolizing bacteria and you will not put as much weight on. So these prebiotic friendly flora definitely help us stay lean. Also, it's interesting with the fats, and there needs to be more research how the different types of fats promote the different types of bacteria shifts and metabolism. That's all pretty new at this point in time. But I think it's all fascinating how the shifts in these bacteria can really determine the outcome of so many things, with weight and diabetes being one of them, but so many different illnesses, even Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and all these things today are really relating back to the gut microbiome.
If someone came to you today and said, I have Alzheimer's disease, what should I do to change my gut biome so I can maybe live longer or have better brain function? Would you feel confident at least pointing them in a certain direction without being prescriptive? Do we know enough to at least say this is a wise move, even if we don't know what's going to fix things?
Well, we know a few things that are associated with, let's say, arresting and or promoting the onset of senile dementia, right? We know lack of sleep facilitates its development. A poor diet, a Western diet, a pro-inflammatory diet. Believe it or not, the number of hours watching television and being sedentary. But also the gut microbiome. There's many studies showing that, again, you have more of these fat-forming bugs. These are more pro-inflammatory. These, again, will be risk factors for developing disease. So it's a bunch of data collectively look at a lifestyle that put us more in a chronic disease mode, and it's how we've poorly treated the gut microbiome, this forgotten organ, that is part of the story.
Would you tell them take a probiotic? Or would you tell them take prebiotics? Would you tell them, you know, like I know I'm not asking for you to recommend any brand unless you feel comfortable with that, but or a species or something, or do we just not know enough to do that? Like would you tell them eat more fat? Would you tell them eat less fat? Would you tell them, you know, obviously no artificial sweeteners, I'm guessing, but just kind of like what? Give me the directional thing, not the perfect prescription thing. You know what I mean?
I like your question. Very open-ended. I'm going to go in a couple of directions with your permission. I mean,
but yeah, please do. It up. Please do.
All right. First, let's talk about probiotics versus probiotic foods or prebiotic foods, right? You know, I'm a believer. My website being the foodmd.com really talks about food is medicine. The old saying by Hippocrates: food is medicine, medicine is food. Probiotics, I think, from a research point of view, when they're pure and they're quantitated, really demonstrate the fact that if these good gut bacteria have a powerful effect. But in real life, if you look at the different studies, one by a consumer's lab, that showed only 8 out of 25 probiotics that they tested really had the number of viable bacteria that, you know, that they said they did on the label.
Right.
New York State Attorney General coming in and looking at various different supplements which are not labeled appropriately. So, probiotics theoretically could be very helpful in the studies and the different conditions like inflammatory bowel disease and even now some in obesity and IBS show benefit. But these are in the research mode when we know that they're pure. The life is like a box of chocolates as far as Gump would say, right? And probiotics is the same. You go to your store and you pick out this bottle. You don't know really if it's reliable enough to really say that this is going to help me. But food's a different story. Or fermented foods, the kefir, even the ones that are on the shelves are pretty robust. Not always the yogurts. Yeah, the kefirs are hundreds of billions of bacteria per serving, especially if you make it yourself.
I was actually about to say life is like a box of sauerkraut because you never know what you're going to get. Because you're using, you know, wild species, like whatever was on there growing, and you're sort of hoping that you didn't get the high histamine formers, and you're hoping you got the right ratio of lactic acid bacteria versus the other ones, and was the temperature and time and light exposure, right? Because I've made buckets of sauerkraut that absolutely just knock me on my ass. And I'm sort of like, okay, so fermented foods, great, if they're fermented with the right species. And that's been like kind of a challenge. And a lot of people who post on the Bulletproof forums are like, well, you know, I like fermented foods, but some of them really don't work. And I don't feel good when I eat them, but I eat them anyway. What's going on there?
You know, like everybody's guts are different.
Yeah.
Right. If you have what they call leaky gut, and a lot of the academic docs hate that term, but it really means is that your gut barrier is weak and your defenses are impaired. And that certain, let's say, antigens and bacterial toxins have more free access to your bloodstream, is that even the good bacteria on these probiotic foods that we just talked about that are pretty potent, you will find that they will also cause reactions because some of them and their byproducts may be permeable. So that's what could be going on in many of those people. And I see that in my practice as well, even with probiotics at high doses.
Do you recommend resistant starch as one of the things you might take with prebiotics? There's a big kind of debate. I mentioned this briefly in my book as well, but it's still a debate about should you be taking like corn starch and other starches that sort of get into the gut to feed bacteria, but may have other problems. Where do you land on that spectrum?
Not that I'm a fan of corn starch in particular. Well, yeah. I guess if it's GMO, genetically modified. Yeah. But, you know, I think there's a number of ways by which we can boost the immunity and the microbiome together with, as you just mentioned, certainly arabinogalactans and prebiotic foods, you know, the artichokes and all kinds of fruits and vegetables. These all are good boosters for the bacteria, but people have different intolerances, and there's a whole group in dietetics of foods called FODMAPs. I don't know if you've had that on your show.
Yeah, we've talked about FODMAPs for sure.
Yeah, these are highly fermentable foods, which can cause gas, bloating, and diarrhea because they're high in osmolarity in some people. So there are foods with other, let's say, functionalities that may cause symptoms in people. And the idea is, or go low and go slow when you start introducing new foods. Don't drink a whole quart of kefir and expect to feel wonderful. Some people will have, adverse reactions.
I dug in on this because I'm a geek, and I was really trying to figure this out. And it turns out that when you're doing yogurt and dairy, if you get Lactobacillus bulgaricus, and I know you're super expert on this stuff, but I also know that no expert I know has memorized all the different species. So this is just a bad question. You just need to tell me, like that's not the right question. I respect that greatly. But like there's bulgaricus and two other lactobacillus species, including Lactobacillus casei. These are like the most common yogurt ones. They form histamine in the gut. So if you're someone who has allergies, you might even be taking antihistamines, and then you take yogurt, then you start making more histamine than you need already. And I think this might be why some people don't do well on yogurt, but if they can switch to Lactobacillus plantarum, which is something that breaks down histamine, it works. And so in my own gut, I worked on getting a balance to reduce histamine sensitivity, and I'm not very sensitive to histamine. Like soy sauce doesn't knock me out anymore. That's a high histamine food, but it did at one time. Do you get to that level with patients? Do you see people who are that sensitive, or am I just like a delicate flower here?
No, there are people who have histamine reactions, clearly, and they need to avoid foods that are high in histamine, and even sometimes there is dietary supplements that actually have the enzyme which facilitate the breakdown of histamine, which people improve on. Food sensitivities is a whole area with multiple mechanisms and gray science that is very challenging to deal with. I personally have kind of shifted away in my practice from that as I see more and more people in functional medicine and more immunologists kind of take that subject head on.
Yeah,
but there's a clear connection, and the gut microbiome appears also through the immune system be playing a role in that as well.
Cool. What about artificial sweeteners? Things like Splenda or aspartame and acesulfame, potassium. There's so many people who've heard the carbs are bad for you, and so then they say, well, you know, I'm just going to add this little packet of whatever artificial stuff to my bulletproof coffee or to, you know, my cheesecake, whatever it is they're eating. And they think it's going to benefit them because it has less calories in it. What is your, like what's your take on it? What did you write about that in the Gut Balance Revolution?
Well, it's an interesting question because back, I believe it was 2008, for the Thanksgiving special, I was interviewed by CBS here. Mm-hmm. Because saccharin was discovered at Hopkins, and they wanted to know it was for their Thanksgiving special. They want to talk about sweeteners and artificial sweeteners just for 1 or 2 minutes. And they interviewed me for like an hour, and I had all the papers, and it was very compelling. And they felt it was too good just for that segment. It got filed and never really got used again. And plus, the lady who did the interview wound up, now she's on Al Jazeera, but she left CBS, so therefore got canned. But, it kind of led my mind into really doing research on this. And what I've discovered over the years, and particularly over the last year, is that there's a clear link between the ingestion of these, let's say, these NutraSweets, these chameleon sweeteners, and the onset of diabetes.
Yeah.
And the study that came out in February clearly showed that the linkage is that these artificial sweeteners destroy your gut microbiome. And through that, promote the onset of diabetes. So here we are recommending to people to cut down on your sugar intake and substitute with artificial sweeteners, yet we're promoting diabetes because we're actually destroying your gut microbiome. It's really eye-opening.
One of the things that just drives me nuts is I went through this when I weighed a lot. I said, all right, I discovered some Atkins kind of stuff in the early 90s. And I'm like, all right, I'm gonna try this. But I, of course, used a lot of NutraSweet. And then one day, I figured out that the stuff made me completely pass out because it causes blood sugar swings, and I was basically drooling on myself from NutraSweet. So I finally got myself off that, which took a while. But then I switched to some other harmful sweetener, and I ended up going on acylsulfame potassium, which is, all of these are messing with my gut biome, and I didn't know. But acylsulfame potassium also causes benign nodules to grow on your thyroid, which I got. And it's like, you know, that's probably 8 years of switching from one artificial sweetener to another because I believe that I had to like cut calories or cut sugar. And well, you do need to cut sugar, but you need to not replace it with crappy sweeteners. And if that message just got to a broader number of people, it seems like a few companies wouldn't benefit very much from that, like big chemical companies. But like the national healthcare costs would go down like by a measurable percentage, maybe double digit. Am I overstating that?
No, because soda consumptions of all type are really hazardous for your health and clearly have been linked to obesity and diabetes, especially in children. And so carbonated beverages in general really make us acidemic to a very small degree or lower our blood pH. And that's going to leach our bones of minerals by being acidemic. So that is one thing that all carbonated beverages do. So you don't want to have too much of them anyway, whether they got sugar in it or not.
So even like sparkling mineral water?
Unfortunately, if it's carbonated, not if it's, you know, if it's naturally, you know, has gas in it, you know, but when you start pumping bicarbonate in it, yeah, you're going to have it's carbonic acid. I mean, look in Coca-Cola, it's phosphoric acid plus it's carbonic acid. And if for those who, you know, you could put on a car and you'll see the paint strip right off. It's very acidic.
Isn't that the same acid, though, that we get from breathing carbon dioxide? Like, and as soon as it's in the body, then it makes you absorb more oxygen?
Right, but you have buffers in your body to keep your pH neutral.
Right.
You have protein buffers, but if you start to go too low, where do you get it from? You get it from your bone.
Or you get it from oxygen. I want to do more research on this
bone.
I'm definitely familiar with the phosphoric acid. It's one of the reasons to not do soda. But I've never, I dug in on this because I had a couple clients who felt weak after drinking, in mixed martial arts, they felt weak after drinking sparkling water. But I have other people like me, especially when I fly, if I drink it, it does amazing things for me. My brain works much better when I drink bubbly water. And I think it has to do with oxygen uptake, but I don't have full evidence. So you've inspired me to dig in on that one. Is this something that you've done a lot of research on? Like, can I hit you up offline about that? Or is it something that I should just go out and look at?
We could talk about it offline. I've done some posts on it.
Okay, I'll check out your posts.
I have a brother who unfortunately he drinks nothing but seltzer, and I worry about him. So I send him a little material once in a while, just to kind of tickle his interest. But yeah, no, I mean, you know, Pellegrino is a great thing, and I order it when I go out. But I wouldn't take a whole case and just suck down Pellegrino all day, for example.
That is interesting. I like it because it's a high sulfate water, even though it's made by Nestle, which does a lot of evil things. and so it's like, well, what do you do there? But I probably drink about a liter to a liter and a half a day, and my system is almost too alkaline, given all the other stuff I eat. Like I flirt with being hyperalkaline. And
wow, then maybe you can can tolerate that, not someone who has a lot of red meat.
Well, I have a lot of red meat. I had lamb chops for lunch, but I don't have a lot of meat. I have moderate protein. Like, I think people who eat excessive amounts of protein are just asking to die early. You know, enough protein to rebuild things and keep muscle mass, but not like, it's not a good fuel source, right? So, you've piqued my interest on this one. I think this is due for some more research. I'll look at what you've written, and I would be sad if I had to drink less sparkling water. I will remain to be convinced, but you have me really thinking. Thank you. All right.
Okay.
Let's get back to the gut. When you drink sparkling water, does it mess with your gut bacteria? That's another big question I do not know the answer to.
I don't know, but actually a lot of us use it. It's a nice digestive aid because if it's low acidity,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have that with the meal and you kind of like it. It's a digestive booster.
Yeah, it makes me feel good for sure when I drink. You kind of crave it.
When I'm out, I get, you know, I just mentioned the brand, but I have sparkling water when I'm out.
Yeah, I got a lot of flack because I recommend San Pellegrino because Dr. Stephanie Seneff came on. We talked about sulfate. There's only one mineral water that has high sulfate levels in it, and that's it. Anyone who knows my work knows I don't really stand for big companies doing bad things. At the same time, it's like you had to drink something, and tap water was really a bad idea. So,
I got you.
So now let's say that one of our listeners today, they're probably sitting at work. Listening to this, and they're going, all right, so these guys are talking about sparkling water, gut biome, sweeteners are bad, and all right, they got the message. And they're like, okay, but I know I have bacteria in my gut, and I know I probably have the wrong ones or the bad ones, or there's a reason my pants have to be this big, so maybe I have the bad bacteria. What do I do right now in order to give me thin people bacteria, for lack of a more nuanced way of asking the question?
So the way I do it, and I recommend that people do it, is like a 3R approach. Is first, we want to, you appreciate this, reboot, right? If you got like a malfunctioning computer, we all have them on occasions, we want to reboot them. We want to reset the body metabolism, right? And to do that, as we had discussed about quote-unquote detox, mm-hmm. is we want to really reset the metabolism by going on a more ketogenic diet,
yep.
right? Something you're very
familiar with. Yeah, we agree on that one.
Right? Right. Yeah. No. Yeah. And at the same time, though, we want to cut off the bad carbs and the bad inflammatory fats, so the bad bacteria don't proliferate. So it's like you have a garden and you want to weed out some of the bad bacteria, right? And you want to then recultivate and refertilize, and then you start to replant or you start to rebalance, and we put in the good bacteria and a fertilizer for them in the second phase. And that's with the good pre and probiotic foods that we've been alluding to. Final phase is maintenance, and I think you really like this, is that there's been studies on Mediterranean, a lot of studies on Mediterranean diet with preventing Alzheimer's and cardiovascular disease, but also to sustain weight loss. And there's a study that I cite in the book that clearly shows that if you alternate the ketogenic diet with the Mediterranean diet, that's the best for sustaining
yep.
weight loss.
The cyclical ketosis thing, it works.
So that's okay. What we're looking at in the program. And people swear by it rather than swear at it. And I'm getting a lot of good feedback. You can look on Amazon. You can look on my Facebook. I'm very, very thrilled that this is really working out for a lot of people.
How long do you recommend people stay in ketosis before they switch to Mediterranean, where they'll eat enough things to be out of ketosis?
Well, it's interesting because you got another phase in between. You got really when people go and they start refeeding. It depends on how much weight you want to lose. And I think that's where it becomes more individualized. Generally, if you want to lose maybe 10, 20 pounds, you're only going to be in it for a month or two before you switch over. And then you're going to find you're going to still lose weight because you're really cultivated this new bacteria. And now you're continuing to foster it because the Mediterranean diet also has fermented foods. Right, you got yogurt and cheeses and all kinds of vegetables and fruits in the Mediterranean diet. So it depends when you really want to plateau.
What happens if you stay in ketosis for months and months on end without breaking it?
You're going to feel less hungry.
Well, that's for sure.
You're going to lose weight. You're going to lose weight. You know, for some people who already have kidney failure, you know, that's where you really want to be careful.
Yeah, that's a corner case.
But that's otherwise, I don't really see too much of a downside. In fact, there's potential therapeutic benefit with cancer.
Oh, yeah.
Right? There have been studies on the ketogenic diet.
Dominic
seizures.
D'Agostino's come on the show. We talked about that a little bit.
So you're familiar with that.
I am, yeah. But just for listeners to keep going, I was just saying, I was guessing that you were referencing his work, and for people who are listening, they would like to hear that episode.
Yeah, sure, sure.
So you're saying epilepsy and cancer. The reason, what I'm kind of digging for there is, in the course of research for my book, I did about 3 months of extreme ketosis. I ate one serving of green vegetables a day, and the rest was fat and protein. And I was trying to sort of replicate the Eskimo diet, lots of krill oil and things like that. Lots of butter, like anything I could do to get the calories in, because I was trying to do a high calorie, high fat kind of thing.
Wow.
And I, towards the end of that 3 months, my sleep monitor showed I was waking up 12 times a night without being aware of it. I never felt rested. My eyes were constantly dry. My sinuses were constantly dry. And I got food allergies to some of my favorite foods, which sucked. And I've just about eliminated those now a couple years later. But what I think happened was that I was so low on carbs that I couldn't make mucus. I didn't have a mucus lining for my stomach. I gave myself leaky gut. I couldn't make tears to keep my eyes and mucus to keep my sinuses moist because I was just so into ketosis and so devoid of carbs. And I've seen other people who are in ketosis for long periods of time, particularly women, you know, they lose their period, they stop menstruating, and they can have adrenal issues. But on the other hand, there's guys like Jimmy Moore, who's a good friend, he'll be in ketosis for like 200 years, and he'll probably live that long. And so I think there's some individual variation there, but because you see patients, and I clearly don't, I'm not a doctor, I'm a hacker. So what spectrum do you see there? Like how much ketosis is enough? Like what's your nuanced, you know, I see patients answer to that.
I haven't seen a lot of people on very long-term ketosis. Okay. And to the extreme amount that you're talking about, people generally try to, at least they get under 50 grams of carbs today a day. And some feel a little tired in the beginning, and some feel very energized. I mean, I see people have different reactions to it. And I think you're right. I think it all depends on the resilience of your microbiome, whether you have a leaky gut or not. There's a lot of factors underlying health on how you react to that, you know, ketogenic diet. I think that plays a factor as well, which is hard to have in a denominator. Sorry about that. I can't control the calls in.
Don't worry about it. You're in an actual medical office, and for people watching, you can tell you're there. You're there at work, and for people listening, now you know he's in his office.
There you go.
And I appreciate you taking time out of your day for it.
That's cool.
Now, let's see. You've written some other things about superfoods for weight loss.
Yes.
What are those? I mean, superfoods are one of those marketing labels. Like I've probably seen white flour labeled a superfood at this point. But what are the ones that are real superfoods that you recommend?
You know, it's funny and keep, you know, referring to the book is that in each phase, I have 10 superfoods for each phase. In other words, blueberries, which are high. Again, these are high in polyphenols. They're prebiotic. They're antioxidant. Cinnamon. Which you can actually flavor your coffee with, which is really one of the highest concentrated antioxidant foods that are available, particularly spices, and also regulates blood sugar. So these are the kind of things that I talk about. Coffee is one of the superfoods.
We right? definitely agree on that one.
I knew that would get your interest. So I talk all about coffee and the diabetes, cardiovascular disease, thermogenesis, you know, different metabolism. Strangely enough, gallbladder disease is lowered with coffee, and liver disease is lowered with coffee. So there's a number, or you could have a whole show you probably have on the medical benefits of coffee.
You know, I'd love
it's
to have
one
a,
of my superfoods.
I would love to have a show on that, but according to the way things are in the U.S., if I ran a show on that, I'd be making medical claims for my own product. So there's actually like sort of a legal gag.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not even allowed to link to some of the positive research about coffee. It's probably stuff that you wrote about in your book. I can talk about human performance in coffee, but if I want to talk about the real big gun stuff that coffee does, not allowed. And it's kind of frustrating as someone who's, you know, I'm here to help. I just want to link to the studies, but it's kind of a conundrum.
Strange. Freedom of speech. Even your guest, you can't
My guests can talk about it, but
I just did.
No, yeah. I'm. It's fine if you do, but I wasn't expecting you to on this. But yeah, if I went out and did that, I would be breaking some regulations there. And in fact, one of my consultants said, "Oh no, you're in the era of controlled speech and not free speech." And I was like, "What? Like, what world do I live in here?" So yeah, sometimes like I'd really like to tell people that about coffee, but you know, someone else will tell them that. So thanks for putting all of that in your book. I appreciate it.
So I just did. Yeah. And I got a nice blog on it, right? That I believe you've seen on my website, all about the coffee.
Yeah.
And its benefits.
Yeah, it was pretty cool, and I love what you said. Actually, I was going to ask you about it, but you were talking about we should see a randomized trial of Bulletproof coffee as a breakfast beverage. I'm actually interested in doing that, so I'm looking to fund some research on a couple of different things I do. There's some mitochondrial enhancement stuff that's really important. That's a part of what makes me tick every day, And I'm getting to the stage where I can afford to start funding research like that. I just need to find who can help me with that. So I think it's worth doing. Maybe hook up with UBiome and see. I had not enough data, but I did send my poop in. We helped UBiome get their funding at the first Bulletproof Biohacking Conference about 3 years ago. And so I had a free sample, and one of my six theories about why Bulletproof Coffee does weird stuff was this ratio of Bacteroidetes to Firmicutes. So I only had two samples from one of the other Bulletproof guys and me, and just not enough to put in my book, but the samples did show lowered Firmicutes and higher Bacteroidetes, which, you know, is what you expect for a microbiome effect from that beverage. Like, the hypothesis and the animal studies say it, and we saw it in two people, but that wasn't enough to make a chapter in a book. But I would love to, like, just know for sure, because maybe it has nothing to do with that. But I do know that it kind of works dramatically. And, you know, it's frustrating to have a bunch of hypotheses about why something works when you know it works, but to not know for sure which one or which ones are the ones that have big effects versus no effects. And, you know, that's just a big knot of knowledge to untangle, but I think it's worth understanding.
I agree.
Did you do any particular... It sort of randomized things in for your book, or were you mostly looking at clinical experience? Like, did you put together a trial or anything?
No, what I did was really organize the data, and I had a hard time keeping up, quite honestly. I drove my editors crazy at Rodale with production deadlines, and I was always up. The data just explodes almost weekly.
Yeah.
About the connection, the biome, the foods, and outcome studies, just like you're alluding to.
Yeah, Rodale's a good publisher for that. They also published the Bulletproof Diet. So,
yes, that's right. That's right.
A lot of people listening probably wouldn't understand how impactful it is to work with someone who helps you get the knowledge out there. Some publishers are just like you know, turn the crank and make a buck, and others are really kind of committed to health. And so I was a virgin author. I really didn't know what the heck I was doing. And I was grateful that I was able to include some last minute stuff, because you're like, oh my God, here's a study that what I thought was there didn't happen. And literally sometimes it was an hour before the deadline when I would send it in. I'm guessing you were the same way.
Yeah, one, it was like midnight plus 8 minutes, and it was due at midnight. And it was, you know, crazy stuff, as you can imagine.
So, all right, I have a confession to make. When I was doing one of the final big editing runs, for several days in a row, I slept 2 hours a night. I basically stayed up till 7 a.m., slept from 7 to 9, woke up, cranked through. I was using all sorts of interesting biohacking technologies. I was using colored light for mitochondrial enhancement, and basically pulled out all the stops. I was in a flow state almost the entire time, and I wrote some like tens of thousands of new words that needed to be added. But it's kind of biologically expensive, so I was taking adrenals and whatnot. You had to have lost out on some sleep when you were writing your book.
There's no question.
It's like having a baby.
No question.
So
there's no question.
What did you do to stay resilient while you're writing your book? Like, this is the stuff no one ever talks about. Like I'm sure everyone wants to know that, because everyone misses out on sleep when they have a big project.
You know, it was a long, long project, and I had a lot going on with work and everything else. So what I found, unfortunately, I found that on the weekends had some sanctity. I always had to have recovery sleep. And that's when I was at my highest functioning for the book. Recovery sleep, and I would just work strictly on the book. Those are my weekends for quite some time, for over a year, with you know, minor holidays and family things. But, you know, during the week, my sleep was also very sacred, because I'm taking care of patients. So I make sure I had enough sleep during the week. And on the weekends is when I really compensated, you know, and stayed up late and so on and so forth. So it was a little bit of a balancing act with sleep.
Did you take any specific supplements or anything like that, or change your food at all?
I put myself on my program just for the sake of it, more than once, particularly after holidays. You put on 5 pounds, I lose it almost, you know, effortlessly. Mm-hmm. So that was, you know, yes, you know, I also, I found myself really heavily, and ever since then, on salmon. Really heavy in my diet, because basically one of my dishes is Jerry's salmon salad, which actually became a dish at this restaurant that I talk about in the book. And since then, just about, I wouldn't say every day, but close to it, I definitely have fish. And I found myself even more vital and more functional. So I think that was one of the key, you know, one of the key changes. And omega-3s, obviously, I did, you know, omega-3, so I'm really on a high omega-3 diet at this point.
Do you ever worry about being so high on omega-3s that your cell membrane ratios kind of get shifted negatively?
You know, I'd have to test that out. I'd really have to test it out, because you want to have a full spectrum of essential fatty acids. I also really, you know, I do quite a bit of olive oil as another fat.
So you probably get some omega-6s there.
And some dairy dairy in the form of yogurt. So I do have balance, but I try to keep the omega-3s really cranking.
It's a good idea. And there's some people out there who, you know, if you have enough DHA, you can, you know, walk through lava and you'll be fine. And it's like, well, DHA for the mitochondria is good, but too much DHA for the outer cell membrane seems like it can actually disrupt things. And there was a time when I got my ratio of omega-6 to omega-3, and for people listening, this is a bit geeky, but omega-6s are pro-inflammatory, but you need some in your cells, and omega-3s are anti-inflammatory, and those are the good ones. But I got my ratio down to 1.28 to 1, and the anti-aging guys recommend 4 to 1, and if you eat an American normal diet, your ratios are 40 to 1 with more inflammation and very little anti-inflammatory. So I went so far into anti-inflammation that I was probably the second lowest reading that I've ever seen. The lowest reading, by the way, is Dr. Larry Smarr from UC San Diego, who's another biohacker who looks at gut biome. I'm sure you must be familiar with his work, right?
I've heard of him.
So his ratio is 1 to 1. I'm like, darn it, you beat me. It may not be healthy to go that low. And I find most people can't get that low unless they're doing pretty unusual dieting, things like that. But that's one of those concerns that I'm starting to ask experts like you, because I think high omega-3 is good. Crazy high omega-3 maybe isn't so good, but I don't think we know where crazy high is yet. So that's one of those interesting questions. And does omega-3 affect your gut biome is the other big question. Do you know anything about that?
Recent study shows that it does.
Wow,
that it turns on the fat burning metabolism through the gut. Yes.
It's fantastic. Amazing. Is there actually value to going out and doing something like a eubiome genetic analysis of your gut, given that every meal changes your gut bacteria so profoundly?
Yeah, I mean, you know, within 24 hours, you can certainly, you know, you can destroy yourself quite quickly on a Western diet, and it does take a little time to build it back up. But you're right, but you want to have something that's stable and resilient at the same time, and that takes work, especially in today's, you know, everyday living. Right.
Yeah.
Most people eat 50% of meals are eaten outside the home.
And then you don't know what you're getting at all.
Box of chocolates.
Yeah. Nice.
Box of chocolates.
Well, I'm tempted to get 6 months worth of eubiome kits and then record everything I eat for 6 months and spend an awful lot of time putting little Q-tips in vials. But then I'd have to crunch the data, and that would be too much work. Like, I would collect it, but I would never crunch it because of life. But I'm hoping that we do get some studies like that. Eubiome is really cranking up their game. Have you done, or do you recommend one sort of genetic test for your gut bacteria, or any one particular way that people can quantify their gut bacteria? I'm just using them because I know them, but there's American Gut Project, and you probably use some clinical stuff that's way better.
You know, it's a really good question, because the technology came out about 8 or so years ago with a company. And looking at, you know, like you mentioned, the Firmicutes, the bacteroidetes, and that was kind of the obesity index. That was kind of like the, you know, and looking at pathogens using PCR.
Mm-hmm.
When that became kind of new and all the criminology shows started to use DNA testing and PCR, so the doctors did it too. But now as they perfected it, the same company looks more at biodiversity, right? I mean, it'll look at pathogens and look at, you know, as you mentioned, some of these organisms. But also biodiversity is key, because if you want to live a long, healthy life, you have to have an enhanced biodiversity. As we get sick and old, we have a limited biodiversity, antibiotics, limited biodiversity. So there's some companies now that look specifically at what I've just been talking about, the biodiversity, which I think is key, as well as the different species, as you just mentioned, with eubiome.
So it's sure early days. I feel like it's like the homebrew computer club time from when we first invented PCs, but now we're doing it for what's going on in the gut, and it's so incredibly exciting, and there's so much we don't know. I'm thankful that you put together what we do know into the gut balance revolution, so people can basically say here's what we know, or what we think we know anyway, and this is directionally accurate, the things that we could do. And there's a question. I'm sort of winding things up because I know that you're in the middle of your workday. There's a question that I've asked everyone who's been on the show, and it's based on your knowledge, not just from work, but like your life's path, including that doctor who told you about how you weren't going to be a doctor, not looking like that, whatever else it was. But given all of that knowledge, the top three recommendations you'd make for someone who walked in the door and said, you know what, I want to be a better human being, I want to perform better at everything, what should I do?
Okay, so there's a lot of facets or elements to health, okay? I keep on having these R's come up in my head. It's about relax, which means de-stress, and, also sleeping. You know, just kind of your body has to be able to unwind. How we eat, we've been talking about that all during this interview, is eating better, relaxation, having balance in your life, and building up resilience. And I think those are really the keys to really living a longer and healthy life, and also, having a healthy social life, because in many studies showing those who are isolated, do much poorly than those who have a really good social network. So you want to have a very healthy social network as you go on in life. And I think those are some of the keys that I see come up.
Awesome. Thanks. I'm waiting for the study that shows that having a healthy social network actually means your gut biome makes better stuff, because there's probably a connection. It wouldn't surprise me at all.
There may be. Yeah. There may be, because there's data about how, at least in animals, caged animals, how they exchange their microbiomes, and how you can actually have a lean mice help an obese mice get leaner with the right diet, because they exchange their microbiomes to some extent.
And there are studies that say if you have fat friends, you're more likely to be fat. And that could be a gut bacteria transfer thing. And I'm not saying don't hang out with fat people. I'm saying when you hang out with fat people, help them be thin. It's doable. Like, we have the technology. So
yeah, got it.
Awesome. Well, thanks for your work, and thanks for being on Bulletproof Radio. And would you tell listeners where they can find your book, say the title again, and give me a URL where you want people to go?
The Gut Balance Revolution. They can go to thefoodmd.com, where I talk more about myself, my blogs, and give information about the book, and Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all these different book sites are at their local bookstore.
All right. Dr. Jerry Mullen, thanks for being on Bulletproof Radio. Have an awesome afternoon.
Yeah, you too. My pleasure.
If you enjoyed today's episode, do me a favor. Go out and check out Dr. Jerry's work. These are people who have spent months and sometimes years or decades pulling together knowledge. And it's a really big thing when you decide to write a book, because it takes hundreds or even thousands of hours. And it's actually harder to write the book because you're boiling all this knowledge down of all these things, just choosing the most important things to share. It's a big act of creation. So if you enjoyed this episode, you learned something from it, you want to learn more, the best way you can say thanks is buy the book and then go out there and give it a good review. And that means more to authors like Dr. Jerry and me than you probably know. And while you're at it, I really appreciate it when you go out on iTunes and say, hey, Bulletproof Radio rocks. Give us a good review too on there. That goes a long way. Have an awesome day.
The Human Upgrade, formerly Bulletproof Radio, was created and is hosted by Dave Asprey. The information contained in this podcast is provided for informational purposes only and is not intended for the purposes of diagnosing, treating, curing, or preventing any disease. Before using any products referenced on the podcast, consult with your healthcare provider, carefully read all labels, and heed all directions and cautions that accompany the products. Information found or received through the podcast should not be used in place of a consultation or advice from a healthcare provider. If you suspect you have a medical problem or should you have any healthcare questions, please promptly call or see your healthcare provider. This podcast, including Dave Asprey and the producers, disclaim responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. Opinions of guests are their own, and this podcast does not endorse or accept responsibility for statements made by guests. This podcast does not make any representations or warranties about guest qualifications or credibility. This podcast may contain paid endorsements and advertisements for products or services. Individuals on this podcast may have a direct or indirect financial interest in products or services referred to herein. This podcast is owned by Bulletproof Media.